Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. For decades, obesity and weight loss were treated as a matter of willpower and workouts, freighted with morality and contradictory methods, experts and fads, Weight Watchers, Atkins, South Beach Diet, gastric bypass surgery, intermittent fasting, paleo, keto, the list goes on and on. You've probably even tried a few of these yourself. But 5 years ago, Wegovy was released as an injectable semaglutide to treat excessive weight, and it sort of kicked off a revolution. Now, one in five Americans has taken one of these drugs, and one in eight is on one now. And North Carolina has emerged as a powerhouse in the global weight loss drug boom. From major pharmaceutical investments to manufacturing operations and research, over the years, we've been positioned at the forefront of an industry that's rapidly reshaping both healthcare and the broader economy. Joining us this morning to talk about the weight loss drug boom and our state's place in it, we have Dr. Sarah Rowe, Director of the UNC Health Medical Group Weight Management Service Line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Cody Kinsley, Senior Policy Advisor at Johns Hopkins University and former North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary. Good morning.
Good morning, Eli. Great to be here.
And Brian Gordon, Business and Technology Reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning, Eli.
So, Dr. Rowe, let's start with you. I'm about to turn 40, and I can't remember a medical revolution like this in my lifetime. It feels like you have to go back to the rise of antibiotics some 80 years ago or vaccines before that to really find a comparison for something that's kind of a one-shot medicine which just fixes something, maybe even, quote-unquote, cures it. How big a deal are these drugs in weight loss, weight management, and the other conditions that they are approved to treat?
Thank you, Eli. It truly is a powerful revolutionary drug and has and will continue to shape how we treat obesity. So this is a groundbreaking discovery that literally changed how we deal with obesity. I've been a primary care physician for a very long time in North Carolina. And, you know, I had a particular interest in lifestyle strategies, but nothing worked, you know. So in 2016 is when American Association of Clinical Endocrinology published a practice guidelines for endocrinologists on how to treat obesity. At the time, as a primary care physician, nothing was working. So I go, why don't we try this? And this practice guideline incorporated the pharmacotherapy. And I think that was a pivotal moment for me when we truly shifted from a lifestyle issue to a chronic disease framework. So that changed everything. And we started seeing signals in our primary care clinics. And I wanted to go to the mountaintop and say, hey, this is a holy grail. We haven't seen anything like this in the past. You know, the medical community has to be a little bit careful because we've seen miracle drugs before, like fenfen.
I was just going to say, I remember when I was a kid, there was fenfen and those Olean potato chips. That's not a pharmaceutical, but boy, I remember that.
Yeah. We were cautiously optimistic. So, you know, this GLP-1 drugs have been around for treatment of diabetes since 2005. So we've had some experience with this. So we were just very elated that this discovery happened.
And Brian, You've written about the space North Carolina occupies in this medical revolution and the industry here. So where does our state fit into the whole semaglutide ecosystem? And how did such a big chunk of this business end up here and specifically in your neck of the woods around the Triangle?
Yeah, though Charlotte has been getting some too, which I can say in a moment. But yeah, we're very much, where do we fall in the landscape? We're very much in the center, especially from a manufacturing point of view. So there are two big players and two players only really in this manufacturing space on the enterprise side. And the first one is Novo Nordisk. They make Wegovy Ozempic. And the other one is Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly is an American company. Novo Nordisk is Danish. And they both have increasing footprints in the Triangle area, and Eli Lilly is outside of Charlotte and Concord. So Novo Nordisk was first. They came to the Triangle in the 1990s. And even today, the Triangle is really their U.S. manufacturing base. Eli Lilly, like many, many, many drug manufacturers, has more recently decided to build a two massive facilities, one in Concord, one in the Triangle. But it's really Novo Nordisk that they're the largest private employer in their home county of Johnston County, just outside the Triangle. And for a while, they were making diabetes medications and kind of just trudging along. And then over the past few years, kind of their whole business model has accelerated. And it's really this two 800-pound gorillas in this space.
And what does it look like on the ground where, you know, they are based in places like Clayton? What does it actually look like to see this boom booming?
Yeah, so what I saw in Clayton is a giant factory being built. So this was a little under a year ago. As we might get into, Novo Nordisk, if you look at their stock, if you look at their some of their statements, they are struggling in this two-person race in some ways, but on the ground, seeing the construction, you wouldn't have noticed. They look like they're a company that needs to get bigger because they want to make more of these drugs. And so it was like a mini city being built right next to their existing facilities in the bedroom community of Clayton. And Eli Lilly, I toured their Triangle facility, and yeah, it was just seeing kind of a constant stream of, they make Zepbound and Mounjaro injectables. And so just kind of seeing the constant stream of those go by and packaged and being sent out was not unlike what you see at other factories, but kind of just seeing like, oh, these drugs that you hear so much about, they're made just like, you know, right down the road, was very interesting.
And Secretary Kinsley, on your watch, North Carolina's Medicaid plan started covering drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic, for weight loss, and Medicare for people age 65 and over. My understanding is that they're barred by federal law from doing so for weight loss specifically, but states can decide what they cover or what they don't through their own Medicaid programs. Now, these drugs have drawn a lot of attention for their four-figure monthly price tags. I know there's been controversy, and some other states have even stopped covering them for weight loss. North Carolina is back in that, but not with the employees insurance plan, which we'll talk about. But how did the cost of these drugs impact the state's Medicaid plan? And how did you handle that? And how did you think about it from a policy perspective when you were overseeing that?
Yeah, well, thanks, Eli. I mean, first off, I always like to start here. I think North Carolina is the buckle of the barbecue belt. When we look at the burden of obesity and chronic disease and other chronic diseases related to obesity in this state, it's a heavy toll, and it's a heavy toll on millions, and it costs us millions down the road in the way of long-term care and other costs. And so I was always interested in finding ways that we could invest in our Medicaid program to drive down cost over the long haul. And the conversation that we're having about obesity drugs really roots back into what Dr. Rowe said, was that we continue to think of it as a moral failing and not a medical issue. We don't hone in as a chronic disease, and we know how to treat chronic diseases. Nobody is talking about the fact that HIV entry retrovirals cost tens of thousands of dollars per year. Drugs like Dupixent, which can cost significantly more per year. The North Carolina Medicaid program will spend in total more on a single drug for eczema and other anti-inflammatory issues than it will on GLP-1s. And
I was
yeah,
going to
now having that
mention,
conversation.
I was going to mention Dupixent because that's a drug that a family member of mine has looked at for eczema, and I mean the sticker price on it is wow, and nobody blinks, nobody questions it. Why do you
Yeah,
think that is?
we don't talk about that drug because, again, of this stigma issue. And stigma is a policy, and it's killing folks. So in North Carolina, we decided to cover GLP-1s for the long-term investment value, and the costs still work in our favor because of it. Now, the problem is really specific to insurance, the fact that people churn off of insurance more readily than they see the value. So in Medicaid, people usually stay on for a long period of time. We're covering them for long-term care at the end of their lives often. And so making the investments now yield those benefits long-term. Whereas if you're on commercial insurance or an employer plan, you can't get that return as quickly. And so this really calls the question of how do we come up with better value-based payment arrangements? How do we reduce the churn of folks coming on and off their insurance, which makes the economics make more sense? And I'm sure we'll get into this more down the road in our conversation, but there's also hundreds of these drugs that are in the pipeline at FDA. More competition is likely to drive down prices. We need to tackle patent law. So there's really bigger issues at play here. It's not just about weight loss, and they need to be related and rooted in these broader policy changes. The last thing I'll say is no one is spending more than $1,000 per month on this drug anymore. It's significantly reduced now into the hundreds of dollars per month. And we saw recently action at the federal level where folks on Medicare can get it at $50 a month out of pocket. And I think the prices will continue to come down.
And at the same time, the state healthcare plan, overseen by a different state agency, dropped coverage for around 750,000 teachers and other state employees a few years ago for GLP-1s for weight loss. I believe that's expected to remain the case under the current much-delayed budget deal. $100 million or so would be needed to restore that, is what legislators have been saying. That also seems like a plan that a lot of people are on longer term versus some private sector insurance. Why or how do you think about that? You've got people who are medically needing these drugs, but an insurance isn't covering them. How do you kind of square that circle, and how do you start to change the perceptions around that?
Well, I know that the state health plan has worked hard to try to come up with value-based arrangements. I think they've gone out to bid to the companies that Brian mentioned earlier to try to do to some direct to insurance deals around those drugs, whether it be a subscription model for these products or other lower cost commitments where there's like an upswing, right? If they see the reduction in the chronic disease spend down the road, the company could get a part of that upswing if they sign on. And so far, unfortunately, our pharmaceutical companies haven't bought onto those sorts of long-term health value arrangement deals. But
And Dr. Rowe?
Yes. There isn't a single disease that impacts half the population. So I think that's the deal with trying to get insurances to cover these medications. This is what I said from the very beginning for state health plan. The bar for getting on GLP-1 is too low. So right now, the lawmakers found it was just too expensive, so they eliminated for everyone, right? We need to raise the bar and have a limited amount of coverage for state health plan employees.
And when we
Yeah, we,
return,
we...
we when we return in about 90 seconds, we'll look at how these drugs actually work and what that more limited coverage could look like. That's coming up on Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. We are talking about all things GLP-1 today with Dr. Sarah Rowe from UNC, Cody Kinsley, a healthcare strategist and former NCDHHS secretary, and Brian Gordon, reporter with the NNO in Raleigh. So I wanted to go back to you, Cody, and let you finish your thought there. We were talking about the state health plan and how employees right now are not able to get coverage for GLP-1s for weight loss.
Well, and it's really that the state health plan can't get the lower prices that the Medicaid program can. That's the primary differential, which puts it in place, which it has to make a choice that I know it doesn't necessarily want to make. We've seen other states able to negotiate other prices for their state health plans. And also, as Dr. Rowe was mentioning, bridge in lifestyle management and kind of a wraparound service that helps support individuals, not necessarily all get GLP-1s, but start to mix together coaching, nutrition, other supports to really part of a broader value-based arrangement and support. And we know that when we really do that wraparound, folks, then we can lower the cost and kind of drive down. But bottom line is that we have to work to get these prices down, and that means tackling patent reform, that means tackling more value-based payment arrangements, and that's going to benefit everybody on every insurance type.
And Dr. Rowe, in your practice, what does this look like? You mentioned having a different bar for how people access GLP-1s and maybe changing how they are used in terms of the other services that are provided.
Yes. So April 1st, 2024, is a date seared in my brain because 25,000 state health employees all of a sudden lost coverage. So patients who have income flexibility have paid out of pocket and is able to maintain that weight loss. But the population, the state health plan employees who lack income flexibility, these are our teachers, our bus drivers, our admin staff who are not able to pay out of pocket even the $350 that is currently priced at. So what I have seen is the group with higher burden of obesity, higher or more serious comorbidities, the obesity-related complication, are literally being shut out, while the group with less disease burden is just paying for it out of pocket. So that's why I'm pleading with lawmakers to say we need to really raise the bar for GLP-1s with those who are at the highest risk, not just cut it out altogether, because these patients are really struggling and they're getting hospitalized. They're developing not just high blood pressure, prediabetes, they're developing heart disease, kidney disease, liver disease, which in the end, it's gonna cost the state more money. So what I'm pleading with lawmakers is to raise the bar, but have a limited access for these highest risk state health employees.
And Brian, one of the ways that we've talked about this problem being confronted is eventually with costs coming down. If these drugs continue to become cheaper, then it's less of an issue covering them. What does that look like in terms of research that companies like Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly are carrying out? And what do you know about what is coming in the pipeline?
Yeah. And so I think for a number of years, Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly, the name of the game was just making these as fast as possible. And that ties into the price. Some of the state documents where they were talking to the state about getting incentives to build the Concord plant, Eli Lilly's, for example, it was just speed was very much emphasized. And one, it's that your patients can then get access to it because this was an emerging drug. The demand was unprecedented. And two, because these drugs were officially considered by the FDA a shortage, something called generic compounders, we see ads for them, Hims, Hers, things along those lines. We're able to make generic versions legally, because if there's a shortage, then the FDA allows people to come into the market. So that created new competition. The two-man race all of a sudden became a many, many person race. And so they very much wanted to make these drugs to end the shortage so that those compounders could no longer legally enter this space. Now, those compounders had had a very long runway, and there's been some interesting sort of fighting slash now joining with those compounders for those two companies. But for a name of the game, or the name of the game for a while, make them as fast as possible. I think the biggest news of the last year, which was seen coming, is that these injectables, which we should say these traditionally were about once a week injectables, both companies have released much anticipated oral versions. And so the hope is that they could be more effective, but also just easier of use. Some people don't like needles. And so Novo Nordisk makes their oral Wegovy from the Triangle. My understanding is Eli Lilly just makes injectables at their North Carolina plant. Again, they're more like geographically diverse in the US, where we're, where Novo Nordisk is very much just in the Triangle in the US. And so that's added a new chapter, is now kind of the race for oral. And there are new competitors trying to enter too. Genentech, which is a Roche company, is trying to build in Holly Springs. There's a town in the Triangle called Holly Springs where it seems every drug manufacturer is opening right now. Yeah, so it's a very exciting space.
And Cody, from your perspective, you've been working on the state side, seeing these companies establish big operations in North Carolina. What did that look like when you were in state government and these companies were coming here and, you know, expanding production lines and really racing to make these as fast as possible? And do you expect costs to keep coming down for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, we know that there are over 100 of these GLP-1 agonist drugs that are in the FDA pipeline. Increased competition will continue to drive down prices. And as Brian was mentioning, the recent move to pill forms, I mean, and these pills are pennies to make, and yet we continue to see the prices be prohibitive for folks to get hundreds of dollars. And so the markup between the production versus the price is still massive. Even for drugs that, you know, the GLP-1 agonists have been for diabetes on the market 16 years prior to being transitioned to weight loss drugs. And this is why I continue to go back to patents. We have to have competition conversations. We also have patent conversations. You know, among the 12 most popular drugs in Medicare, the average patent length is 37 years. And I think as a society, we have to have a conversation about whether these drug companies deserve that level of protectionism and whether innovation is really, you know, what is going to drive the price down. And so I think that's important. Look, North Carolina is a great place for these biopharma companies to base for a lot of reasons. I continue to credit Roy Cooper as one of our best governors ever and love his work in that space.
And one issue that we've talked about briefly is sort of the stigma around weight and the way that we've transitioned some, but maybe not all the way, actually, I'm sure not all the way, to viewing weight and obesity as medical issues versus morality, personal, lifestyle exclusive issues. Dr. Rowe, how have you seen that play out in your practice and over your career? What has that shift looked like in terms of how we view this medical issue?
Yes. I think it's safe to say the weight stigma, bias, and discrimination is still very, very pervasive, even in the healthcare settings. There, it actually causes harm both physically and mentally for our patients. And this weight stigma, rather than motivating weight loss, it actually promotes weight gain. There are two types of stigma. It's an internalized stigma. Patients themselves blame themselves when they fail a diet. Oh, I must have poor willpower, etc. But what they don't realize is the food system, the food environment that we're living in, and I think Cody refers to this often, is just horrendous. It's stacked against them. So I think we need to just continue to educate the public and also healthcare workers about it's not just the individual responsibility, but there's also a systems level guardrails that we need to put in as well. The external weight bias from society and healthcare setting is tremendous as well. So I think we need to just continue to educate. And we have a monthly obesity conference that we have run for the last 5 years to educate our community clinicians on the issues of stigma, because that is still very pervasive.
But it seems like there's also a stigma that people feel and experience around using GLP-1s. There was a study I was reading last week by a professor at Rice University that found women taking GLP-1s face more stigma than women who had not lost any weight. The study's authors wrote, quote, "Participants rated the GLP-1 user more negatively than someone who had not lost weight at all." Have you all found that to be true? And what do you think's driving that? Because it feels kind of like a can't win scenario.
Yeah. So there's a lot of misconception about the treatment of obesity. So I think that's what's driving it. And as a weight management physician, we're not in this business for weight loss. We're trying to improve health. So when we frame it in that way, I think patients are more accepting of why they're on a certain medications. So that has helped. But I think there's still that stigma. So patients hide the fact that they're on these medications.
And I just want to say that stigma is deadly. I mean, one of the leading causes of severe maternal mortality risk is documented as obesity and hypertension related to obesity. I mean, here we have a drug that is a remarkably proven to help kind of tackle that issue and help close those gaps. And yet people are, you know, scared if they do and scared if they don't. And that's what is so frightening about this. We haven't even touched on the fact that these GLP-1s have such positive impacts on addiction, on other issues that are related. And so, you know, I think to me, the fact that we've got folks stuck in this space is really tragic.
Yeah, Cody, if I could play interviewer for a second, I've been curious just from the outside as not a medical, like how much of those non-obesity side effects, and this is for Dr. Rowe too, are sort of bluster versus real. I know Novo Nordisk had a Alzheimer's sort of study that fell short, but then you also hear like, oh, beyond obesity, these could do wonders for X, Y, and Z. And I've always had trouble parsing, is that real or is that to help their stock price and or like help get it covered if it is like a non-obesity benefit as well? So how do you kind of see, I guess you answered it a little, but.
I'll start, and Dr. Rowe, please add on. You know, well, we've seen independent reviews, especially around cardiovascular risk. So individuals who are already at higher risk for heart attack and stroke, after taking GLP-1s, they have reduced reoccurrence or likelihood of those events happening. And so we actually see many folks, not for obesity, but for heart disease and stroke and increased risk there, get prescribed GLP-1. We think that those are related to the broader anti-inflammatory impacts of these drugs, which is incredibly promising. I think some of the research also is promising around substance use disorder and addiction. And so we see that also among folks that are taking this for obesity or reduced use of alcohol, reduced use of other drugs. And that's really promising as another tool in our tool belt to tackle those issues. I think some of the questions around Alzheimer's or other broader dementias, I think are still a little bit yet to be proven. But Dr. Rowe?
Yes. So aside from the weight loss itself, the benefits of weight loss, there are all these other conditions that Cody just mentioned. It improves sleep apnea symptoms. It improves heart failure. It improves advanced liver disease, fibrosis. So there are so many other benefits of these medications. So it really trumps all the minor side effects. And majority of the patients, if we titrate slowly, 90% of patients tolerate this medication as well. The reason why patients get off of it is because of the cost. they can't continue to afford, pay out of pocket, because 80% of employer-based insurance just aren't covering it, and that is just continuing to get worse.
And regarding that and some of those other conditions that you mentioned, Cody and Dr. Rowe, when you have people who are, say, pre-diabetic or taking for other reasons, then those conditions improve, the blood work improves, and insurance says, like, okay, great, looks like you don't need this anymore. How often do you see that in your practice, Dr. Rowe, and how do you deal with that?
Every day. So before, I used to get a smile on my face if somebody has type 2 diabetes, because I immediately could get them on GLP-1 to lose weight. That day has passed. Patients lose, it's an excellent blood sugar reduction drug. So when their A1C falls below 5, the insurance goes, oh, you no longer have diabetes. And I have seen daily with patients with history of type 2 diabetes being denied the GLP-1s for weight loss. It's to treat the diabetes. So this is just getting worse. And as we said, we understand the impact of having 50% of the, being able to treat 50% of the population, but they need to identify these high risk patients and continue to increase access for this limited group of people.
Yeah, and I know people who, have had their, is it A1C? I'm not a doctor, I don't want to say it wrong. Yeah, who have had their A1C coming down and being afraid that it would actually leave the diabetic or pre-diabetic range, because then they will lose access to coverage for those. So that's a weird place to be in.
Yeah.
And that's where some of the tension. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Dr. Rowe.
Okay. Another thing that I'm seeing is patient would have these FDA indicated conditions, and they would say, the insurance will say, it's covered, but it's going to cost you $800, higher than the self-pay cost.
And we have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk more about access to GLP-1s and why those Serena Williams commercials are everywhere. This is Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. This morning, we're talking all things GLP-1 with Dr. Sarah Rowe of UNC, former North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Cody Kinsley, and Brian Gordon, a business and technology reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. So if you turn on the TV pretty much any hour now, you're going to see ads for these drugs. I think I've memorized every word of that Serena Williams dancing commercial. I get ads from Charles Barkley. He's always popping in my feed telling me I need to get with Roe. It's omnipresent. These commercials aren't directly from, the Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. They're from companies like Roe, Hims, other online pharmacies. How does this work, Brian? And how has this become such a big part of this business ecosystem? Because, pharmaceutical advertising is nothing new, but I don't remember being bombarded for ads for, statins for my cholesterol.
Yeah. So I think the original earworm jingle in this space was the Ozempic. Just when I think some people were still asking, what is Ozempic? What is a GLP-1? And that was really, I think it won awards for sort of its catchiness, and that was omnipresent. And that really made Ozempic, even though that wasn't even specifically for weight loss, and it is now, there are many other ones, that's kind of made it like the Kleenex of the space, the Jell-O, the generic. It's just like, oh, you're on Ozempic. Charles Barkley is on Ozempic, even if he's on something else. And so, yeah, it's just, finance people in the finance space, doctors, like, unprecedented. I feel like that word gets used a lot, but truly this demand, this rise was just like meteoric in terms of the so many people could benefit from this. And so, of course, the pharmaceutical companies see a avenue to advertise these. You mentioned kind of Roe and Hims and Hers, and that's
What role do these companies and these telehealth providers that were in the compounding space in a lot of cases? How did they become kind of these big players, specifically with GLP-1s, and what role do they play now in terms of access?
Yeah, and Dr. Roe, fill me in a little. I think they were a competitor that, instead of fighting the two giants, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, have decided in certain areas to join. It's better to let them do what they're doing rather than fighting. So it goes back to my understanding, the FDA shortage gave them this runway where generic compounders could take the ingredients, it's semaglutide and tirzepatide are the respective medical terms for Wegovy and Zepbound, Mounjaro and Ozempic, and they would compound them and sell them for cheaper and greater competition. Now, as of maybe a year ago or so, that shortage is gone, so they couldn't, yet in many cases they still did. And so Novo Nordisk has fought that, sending letters to the FDA being like, you need to enforce this. I'm sure Eli Lilly was taking similar steps, but in certain cases. So I know Hims and Hers, you see their ads, they're marketing now openly that they're giving out Wegovy. So Novo Nordisk has had a partnership with them. So rather than fight each and every one of these, in certain cases, you join them, you let them sell your drug. And then that doesn't even get to some of the more gray market, black market, kind of DIY even cases where people can buy things from China and kind of make these. So yeah, there's still a lot of competition out there that these two big giants are trying to navigate whether to join or whether to continue fighting.
And obesity and the associated health costs don't fall equally on us like many things. Most things, in some cases, there are racial and socioeconomic disparities. About 47% of Black North Carolinians live with a BMI over 30, compared with about 32% among white North Carolinians. Rural populations also have higher obesity rates. How do these disparities play into this conversation?
I will take this one. Yeah. So in my practice, we see a lot of patients from the rural areas and Black North Carolinians as well. And we've just, you know, 10 years ago, we've noticed these health disparities. So we wanted to create a system. Right now, with all these telehealth companies, what we have created is a medication-only platform. We all know obesity is a chronic relapsing disease. It requires long longitudinal care. So 10 years ago, we did a needs assessment at UNC, and we said, obesity disproportionately affects our minority population, rural population, and socially vulnerable population. What can we do to increase access to obesity care in addition to advocating for GLP-1 access? So what we created was we placed obesity-trained physicians in using the 83 primary care clinics that UNC has and placed them in 9 North Carolina counties. So they have expertise level care within the statewide of North Carolina. So that has really helped increase access to evidence-based, comprehensive, affordable obesity care. So that seems to resonate with many folks, and their, our referral numbers are just skyrocketing.
And how do you balance the people who say, yes, these drugs work, but all these other things that you've pointed to, like access to healthy food and the lack thereof, like the fact that, we drive everywhere in the U.S. I'm thinking some of the Make America Healthy Again, MAHA crowd talking points about our food supply. How do you balance that impulse to treat people with a drug that works and in many cases looks like a simple one-shot solution, with also the reality that, you know, I think it's fair to say we've created an obesity framework in our society where it's kind of the default to be overweight. How do you think about that?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, obesity is not a medication-only disease. It works best when we pair that with the lifestyle component. But here's the problem in North Carolina. Medicaid does not cover nutrition services, and many employer-based insurance, they only cover a handful of behavioral therapy, nutrition counseling services. So that was one of the problems that we had to tackle. So what we decided to do was, okay, I personally have conducted over thousands of dietary assessment. And as Cody will agree, it's not pretty. Many patients are consuming a large amount of sugar-sweetened beverages. Southern champagne, we call it, the sweet tea, which has enormous amount of added sugar. Sodas is another one. So patients are, I call them diet-related conditions that our patients are experiencing. So we said, you know what? They don't have access to these services. So we're going to, while we have them in our clinics via telehealth or in person, we decided to do an assessment of what they're doing, a comprehensive assessment, and decided to just focus on titrating the sugar-sweetened beverage and the ultra-processed food, and do it longitudinally with accountability. So I titrate sugar-sweetened beverage as if it was a drug, and that seems to work beautifully in our region where the diet-related disease is just so overwhelming.
At the risk of sounding like a skeptic, though, that sounds a lot more complicated and like a lot more work than a pill.
Well, and if I can jump on that point, I mean, I think it's important to contextualize this like other diseases. I mean, similar with dementia, we understand the importance more and more now of isolation and other diseases and the impact and long-term risk factors for dementia or cardiovascular disease. Right? We have to empower our healthcare professionals and our broader healthcare system to move more towards a preventative model where there's a lot more tools that support it, right? But at the same time, we don't have folks talking about taking everybody's statins away from them because they could have exercised more to reduce their heart disease, right? So kind of call the question that we're willing to take this drug off the table when we know there's a lot of other diseases that have a lot of other contributing factors as well. So we have to have all of the tools. And my only, one little positive pushback on Medicaid is, Medicaid pioneered North Carolina, first in the nation pilot around getting healthy food to people in three pilot regions across the state. This is our Healthy Opportunities Program. Research that's rolling out today showed that when we got people access to healthy food, we lowered the cost of that of those individuals by $164 per member per month, all in on cost. That's a huge return. That's enough. That's more than to buy GLP-1s for that person on the Medicaid program. And so we've got to continue. There are more tools that we can use to invest in folks. That's a win-win for people.
And Dr. Rowe?
I absolutely reject the notion that healthy foods are more expensive. There are, ways to get healthier options than the highly processed junk food that many of my patients are consuming, such as frozen and canned produce, low-cost protein options, such as beans, eggs, lentils, Greek yogurts, peanut butter, and encouraging them to cook simply at home. My son, who's a college student, he said, "Mom, lunch is like $25 in DC." So he prepares lunch for the whole week with brown rice, a little lean meat, and vegetables for the entire week. So encouraging our patients, I'm actually teaching our primary care docs to actually go into the food that, or dive into the food discussion, because food is that important. When we send a referral to a dietitian, do you know the rate of referral to completion rate? It's less than 30%. And that's in a Cleveland Clinic where the population is very different than our population. So I'm encouraging all clinicians to dive into the food, because many of our patients are suffering because of the overconsumption. I think ultra-processed food for underserved communities, we're at 70-80% of their regular dietary consumption is from ultra-processed foods.
Wow, that is a sobering statistic, and you're going to make me reconsider my lunch choices today. So it feels kind of like the solution is to use these drugs, figure out how to bring the costs down, but also do many of these other bigger societal solutions. You know, what do you think the future of your clinic looks like, Dr. Rowe, in this GLP-1 era? And do you have patients who say, I don't want to do the lifestyle stuff. Just give me the drug. I see the commercials. I hear it does everything for you.
Yes. So for patients like that, we're very patient. And if they need and meet the criteria, yes, we offer them these medication first. And this is what I tell my patients. When your appetite is suppressed, when that biology is being treated with these medications, it's a golden opportunity to reestablish their relationship with food. So that's when we slowly teach them over and over. It may be too over or they're not interested, but over time, they slowly have internalized some of these concepts. So having not just the medications, but that support, I think, is crucial. And because of the scope of folks needing this care, we're encouraging all primary care clinicians to buy into providing this service. And our program has developed a EHR tool that incorporates, it's a pathway, weight management pathway, that helps guide our primary care clinicians so that they're adding the best practices of obesity medicine. And I do have to say one more thing is it's not just GLP-1. We, you know, our program started when we didn't have GLP-1s. So we're very proficient at using the older first generation medication. And what I have experienced is when we pair this titration of sugar sweetened beverage, sweet teas, and ultra processed food, it's making topiramates, phentermines, metformins act like Ozempic. That is what I'm experiencing. And that's the paper that we published at New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst just this month.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention before we end here is that I think it's interesting that these drugs really flowed from other basic science research that started decades ago with chemicals in Gila monster venom. I just find that fascinating given how the current administration in Washington has worked to gut a lot of basic research in so many areas. We've got 1 minute, but are we at risk of missing the next Ozempic with what we're seeing happen to the scientific pipelines in this country?
Absolutely. We're setting ourselves back a generation, whether it's Ozempic or it's the research done on HIV that led to antiretrovirals that were broadly applicable during COVID and other diseases. I mean, the basic science research is fundamental. We cannot lose step, and we're losing the race against every other nation, and this is going to hurt us for the long haul.
Well, that's former North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Cody Kinsley. We've also been joined by Dr. Sarah Rowe at UNC Chapel Hill and Brian Gordon, technology and business reporter with the N&O in Raleigh. Thank you all for the hour. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. See you all tomorrow.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.